Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. It is Monday, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And Monday morning movie reviews, we got a lot this week. Didn't have anything last week, really, but we got a lot this week for the 4th of July holiday weekend. And there you go. And, yeah, so that's all. We got a bunch of stuff coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Lots of movies to talk about. We will also talk about the box office for the weekend as well, holiday weekend. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week, as they have for many years. And they're actually going to have an extra appearance this week on Thursday morning, since we are officially now halfway through the year, which is unbelievable. We do our halfway lists for the best and worst movies of the year, and we're going to do that Thursday morning right here, and they're going to come on down in studio, and we'll talk about the best and the worst movies of 2017 so far, since we are halfway through the year. That's coming up. All right, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Twitter. Follow it at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Let's welcome the guys back to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
Hi. Colin, I understand that you traveled to where? Cincinnati?
Cleveland.
Cleveland. Cleveland,
yeah.
To see
Cleveland.
To see you too.
Yep.
How was the show?
It was amazing. The closing night of their Joshua Tree 2017 tour, and I think they've been kind of fumbling around with the set list a lot over the past couple of months, and now that I've seen the final show, I think they finally got the show down good. So.
Mm. Now, are they doing a European leg?
Yeah, they're going to do a European leg for July and August, and they're coming back to the United States in September for a bunch of dates, a few in the Midwest, none in Chicago, but Indianapolis and Detroit, which is where I'm going to see them opening night when they come back, and then a few down south and a few in the Southwest.
Where are they playing in Detroit? Are they playing Tiger Stadium?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be that.
Okay. All right. Or where the Lions play? That would be the other.
Yeah.
The other possibility. All right. Cool. All right. Well, that's good. And
yeah,
but we
busy
did
weekend. So
yeah, busy weekend is right, and lots of movies came out.
Yeah.
And the only here's the thing: all three of us did not see The House. And evidently, Eric, when we talk a little bit later about box office, not many other people did.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes it's important that this segment reflects what's going on in America.
Yeah.
You know, that we, you know, the studio didn't want us to see the movie, so we said okay, and then audiences didn't want to see it either, so we said okay again.
Yeah, when we get, I mean, it only made $9 million, which is really, is that the worst Will Ferrell opening?
Yep.
Wow.
By millions.
Yeah. Okay. Stranger Than Fiction made more money?
13.4.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting. We'll talk about the box office a little bit later on, but let's get to the new movies. We got some big ones to talk about. Colin, you and I saw Despicable Me 3, so why don't you tell everybody about it?
All right. Yeah, this is the third or fourth, I guess.
If you count the minions. Yeah.
Yeah. So series of animated films about Gru, voiced by Steve Carell, the self-professed master of evil, his yellow minions, his wife Lucy, voiced by Kristen Wiig, and his three young daughters who have managed to soften him up over the years. And now Gru is a member of the Anti-Villain League, but he gets thrown out after not being able to stop another major villain from doing evil, and this leaves Gru and the family financially desperate. And at this point, Gru suddenly learns that he has a twin brother that he never knew he had, named Balthazar Brat.
No, his name is Drew.
Oh, Drew.
Right.
Oh, right. Okay.
Balthazar Brat
is the villain.
Right.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're right. Thank you. Balthazar Brat is the villain in the movie. He's voiced by Trey Parker, and this character is kind of a former child star, now actual or villain. Gru's twin brother, also voiced by Steve Carell, invites Gru and his family to stay at his place, which is a ridiculously huge mansion, and they plot major heist and helps Gru get back in touch with his evil side. So it's getting to the point now where this is these movies are from Illumination Studios. They also did Sing last year. And it's getting to the point now with the studio's movies where I'm watching them and I'm longing for a Blue Sky movie instead.
Oh, man.
no, this is a really labored and really just disappointing on all levels sequel, part three, to a series that I've been generally kind to. I mean, I didn't like Minions, but I gave the first Despicable Me a pass, and I think I kind of liked the second one also. Kind of liked it enough, maybe. I don't know. I don't remember. But now I'm watching this one, and it is just so labored. It is so every character is shouting at you. The Minions thing is really tired. It's really dead to me now. Most of the stuff that I like about the Despicable Me movies have to do with the kids and the family stuff. I think it's usually very sweet and charming. And this one, it all felt flat. And perhaps the biggest crime of all here is casting of Trey Parker as Balthazar Bratt, and it brings nothing to the proceedings. I mean, why are we casting one of the great comedic minds of our time, and a great voice actor in a role like this? And either he's just cashing a check, which is entirely possible, or nobody found anything inspiring for him to do, and he just couldn't be inspired himself. You could just tell that there was a great idea here of getting Trey Parker the voice in an animated film, but nobody did anything with it, including Trey Parker. So that makes the movie especially disappointing. So I barely cracked a smile during this thing. I may have laughed once a little bit, but that's about it. So I'm really done with these movies and this series and the studio. So, no, big no for me.
All right. We disagree big on one thing, and that's Trey Parker. Because I think Oh, yeah. Because I think the villain is by far the best thing in the movie. By far. It made me laugh.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, it made me laugh. I don't think it's, as you were saying, I mean, Trey Parker, one of the greatest comedic minds of all time and one of the greatest voice workers ever. And I don't think he does, near the top of his form in this movie. But I think the character's funny, and I liked all the 80s references, and music cues made me laugh, and the way he's animated and how he moves and dances, it made me laugh, and I thought it was funny. By far the best thing in the movie, as far as I'm concerned. Everything else falls flat. The whole discovery of having a twin brother doesn't work. Julie Andrews makes a voice cameo as his mom. And that character doesn't work. The stuff with the kids and the subplot involving the little girl wanting to get a unicorn.
Oh yeah.
All of that stuff falls flat. We really don't care if Gru gets back in the good graces of, the anti-villain league and gets his job back, which is the crux of the movie. You don't care about the relationship between Gru and Drew. To point out the differences between the two characters, there's nothing really there. And it just falls flat for the most part. But like I said, I really enjoyed the Bratt stuff. I thought the little action figures were funny. I actually liked the big giant robot, the big climax at the end. I thought that was kind of fun. But there's no emotion there. There's really not any big laughs. The Minions are kind of done with me, too. I mean, I will say that I laughed at a couple of things that the Minions did, simply because I've always thought that the Minions were pretty funny. But that's clearly...
I'll give them the spontaneous musical number at that audition thing they went to. I thought that was actually kind of cute.
And I like the stuff in jail, too. I thought the stuff that, the stuff when they're in jail, I thought was funny, too. And, every once in a while, the Minions get off a good one. But that's also reached its point of, doneness. And... on top of what we're saying, how tired this all is, Colin, and uninspired, it ends setting up a fourth one.
Mm-hmm.
Or a fifth one, however you want to count it, because it ends on a cliffhanger. And I was like, what? Seriously? There's going to be another one of these? I mean, so except for Trey Parker, and I know you don't agree with me, but except for Trey Parker and the Brat character, I was not crazy about this movie at all. And it seemed to me that the audience that I saw it with also felt that it was labored. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. There was a lot of kids in the audience who they laugh at the Minion stuff. But, like, everything else, they didn't, like, they're not going to get, you know, like, a sound cue from Dire Straits. You know what I mean? There's all these crazy 80s references and music cues, which I enjoyed because I'm 52. Well, I'll be 52 Thursday. But kids who are, like, 7, 8, how are they going to get the joke that he's, you know, he's got a mullet and he's wearing shoulder pads? Kids are not going to get references that are specific to that time period. They weren't born then. So, I don't know.
I will say this. You'd be surprised at what kids know about the 80s and how techy they were, just from my own, from what I, from things that I overhear. But no, you're right. The audience I was sitting with kind of had that same kind of muted reaction as well.
Right. And I didn't go IMAX and I didn't go 3D on it. I just spent as little money as possible to see the movie. So I don't know if that makes a difference or not. Did you see it in 3D?
No, I don't even remember.
I don't even remember.
I don't think it was.
All right. Well, there you go. So two no's from us for Despicable Me 3. I think I may have liked it. I enjoyed it a little bit more than Colin did, but I'm certainly not recommending it. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin, they join me every week to talk about new movies. We've got some new movies to talk about, and that's all coming up right after we take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday, and that means my dad will call in to tell a jokey time, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. We thank George and everybody at Gale Street for being awesome. Check out galestreet.com. And we're also reviewing the new movies. Lots of stuff came out this weekend, and we are going to review them. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, they join me every Monday morning to review the movies, and then Eric will stick around, and we will talk about box office as well. And, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and you can check us out on Facebook.com/NickDShow and at Twitter @NickDShow. All right, let's get back to the movies. Lots of stuff to review here, so welcome back, Eric.
Hello.
And welcome back, Colin.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Beguiled.
Okay. Well, this is Sofia Coppola's remake of the 1971 Don Siegel film with Clint Eastwood. It was based on a book from a few years earlier than that. And it's the story of John McBurney, who in the Civil War is wounded very nearby an all-girls school. One of the young girls is out one afternoon and discovers him wounded, and realizing that is the right Christian thing to do, she brings him back to the school where he is tended for by the ladies there. Nicole Kidman plays the headmistress of the school. Kirsten Dunst plays a teacher. Elle Fanning plays sort of the bored woman or young lady is just kind of discovering her her inner self, if you will, and he's kind of sectioned off while they sort of realize this is probably the right thing to do. They do realize that the bringing a man into this kind of setting might be problematic, and as time goes on, we begin to see from both sides, how this can be a blessing for at least one person, namely the man, and possibly a curse for the women, who then have to deal with the burgeoning hormones that are going on within the school. Now, this all kind of sounds like, you know, kind of the setup for kind of a Randy Cinemax type of story, but going back to the 1971 film, it's a story that takes on a lot of really kind of interesting sidebars on exactly, you know, who you're siding with or who you should be siding with. In this film, Colin Farrell's character compared to the Clint Eastwood character is a little more mischievous, at least a little more on the surface. He's a little more of a rascal. The women in this film are frankly a little bit more muted than they are in the original film. Now, since I'm starting to get into the review of this, I should just say right off the bat that if there was a word that I would use to describe Coppola's vision of this story, the word is quite simply neutered. Now, that might be exactly what Coppola had in mind, even in an ironic sense. But to me, watching this film, although it does have some good performances, and it does have some scenes that kind of tap into kind of a black humor of the piece, this is a film that completely guts so many things that I think were inherent and interesting and incredibly dark about the original film. Many of the best moments are extraordinarily muted in this version. The movie is about 20, 25 minutes shorter than the original version as well, so by the time it actually kind of gets to a lot of the things that people have seen the previews are probably expecting going in, but they actually don't occur until the last third of the movie. There's a lot of things in her version of things that just it doesn't really click. There are things that are just not escalated up to the kind of fever pitch that should be happening if she's treating this as a gothic horror tale, which is exactly what the original film was. She doesn't seem interested in that. By taking out, ironically, she eliminates one thing that I thought she was going to, would have seen very at home at keeping, which is the kind of the voiceover inner monologues of a lot of the female characters. I mean, ironically, taking away their voice in this film. I was extremely disappointed with Nicole Kidman's character, not so much her portrayal, but more just the way she's written, that again, certain elements of the original story have been taken out, and it really kind of eliminates a lot of her motivation in this film. The Kirsten Dunst character is kind of reduced to the kind of the standard, a woman that needs a man to take her away from things. Granted, given the period setting, this is, there are things like that were going on, but this is, supposedly a more of a feminist type take on this story told from a woman's perspective rather than Don Siegel and Clint Eastwood, looking at these women in kind of a more of a vengeful eye in the original film. And just so many things about this movie just disappointed me by the end. And I just kind of walked out just, kind of hanging my head going, that's all you got, Sophia? Well, maybe you should have gone back to the drawing board and really understood what made this story click in the first place.
Yeah, okay. Colin, what do you think?
I like the movie. It's not one of her strongest films, but I thought that she was mostly interested in the aspect of the story as a kind of a look at the way women can turn a man from this sort of gracious, not prisoner, but patient, and slowly turn him into this primal caged animal. And the way she shoots the film, I think she's trying to make this place look almost heavenly. The way the windows are completely always bleached out, and this fog that's always rolling in, this place feels like it's completely isolated from the Civil War. There's also the lack of the slave character from the film, from that first film. So she kind of takes the theme of race out of it. So I think she's just kind of taking it to the bare minimum, which I thought actually was an interesting approach. And I thought that aspect of it did come through. And I think the performances are worth watching. And I think the way it's shot is particularly gorgeous. There are shots in this movie that I think are just like paintings. They're so beautiful. I don't know. I was kind of taken by it. And I think her refrain from using music was interesting because she's a very musical director, and this one there's hardly any score. There's incidental music. There's music that the kids play once in a while on the piano, but that's about it. I thought Colin Farrell was really good. I thought, I don't know, I liked the movie more than Eric did. I didn't spend much of the time watching the movie and thinking about the original, which I recently rewatched. I just kind of wanted to see Sofia Coppola's take on, you know, what is a novel first and foremost. So, yeah, I'm recommending the movie. It's not one of her best. I can't say I was emotionally involved with it, but just as a piece of filmmaking and seeing her take on a story that and making it her own, it's always interesting to see what she does with stuff like this. So I'm recommending it.
Okay. I'm totally with Eric on this one. I was hugely disappointed with this movie. I will say this, you know, the things that you mentioned, Colin, that are positives, the cinematography is breathtaking. It is a beautifully shot movie, and it is gorgeous to look at. I, too, liked Colin Farrell. I thought Nicole Kidman, I thought some of the acting in it was quite good. I just didn't like what they did with the characters. Now, I guess this is unfair because I spent most of the movie going, watching it going, man, I like the original more. I just, because I really, really love the original film. The Beguiled is one of my favorite Clint Eastwood performances of all time. And it is a really dark, I mean, what he and Siegel did, you know, with the tone of that movie, it's a very screwed up movie. I mean, it is a deeply, deeply disturbing and screwed up movie. Gothic horror to the 10th degree, you know what I mean? And none of that is in this movie. Yeah, the take is different. She, you know, and again, I'm so glad, Eric, that you brought up that she cut out like the internal monologue stuff, because I don't know why she did that. It's, and you know, cutting out certain things to streamline it, I suppose. There are moments in the movie that where the acting really takes it up, you know, a couple of notches. But overall, I think this pales in comparison to the original, which is, if you've not seen the original, it is, as I said, it's a very screwed up movie. I remember the first time I saw that movie, I was a kid, you know, and I thought, oh, Clint, you know, I'm like, oh, this will be fun. This will be like Dirty Harry. He's going to shoot some people. It's a war movie. It takes place in the Civil War. He's made many movies at that time period. They're Westerns. This is going to be great. The movie completely freaked me out when I was a kid. I had no idea what I was watching, and I was way too young to have seen that movie at that time. And you know, this movie, I think, it deboned the entire thing. I just didn't think there was anything there. And I'm a fan of Sofia Coppola very much, except for the movie where Stephen Dorff drives around a lot.
Somewhere.
That's the only one of her movies that I actively dislike. I didn't hate this movie because there's a lot of technical stuff in it that's really good. And again, the cast is strong. I couldn't get, you know, and I guess this is unfair of me. I couldn't get the original out of my mind. You know what I mean? When I was watching it, I just kept thinking, why am I not watching the original?
It's not entirely unfair, Nick, because I mean, our friend Sergio Mims, I think, put it kind of best, where he said, like, if you're going to take out all the stuff that people, you know, guys like us like about the original film, you have to replace it with something.
Yeah.
And I think in this movie that she doesn't go to any pains to replace it with anything. It's like the beats are there, but the music isn't. And, you know, even if you want to take away the gothic horror stuff, you want to take away the slave character, you know, it's just like, you know, if you want to make this some kind of, you know, he said, she said, compared, you know, of the two films, then I want to know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it never comes across in the movie exactly what she's doing.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of turns on the, you know, the really big moment that happens in the third act of the film, where in the original film, there's kind of a clear motivation why it's done.
Yeah.
And in this one, it's just kind of like, well, you know, we kind of have to do it, you know. And it really puts off the emotional injection of Colin Farrell's reaction to it, McBurney's reaction to it, which is very clear and scary in the Siegel version. And here it feels like someone knowing they have to have that reaction because it was in the original.
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, there's really nothing there. It's a pretty empty film. And the original is not. And seriously, like, and by the way, I do want to mention Geraldine Page in the original because she's unbelievable in it. And so I guess I was completely biased when I saw this. Although I got to say, I was really looking forward to this movie a lot. As a fan of Sofia Coppola and this cast, I mean, I love everybody in the cast. I was really looking forward to it, and I expected her to, you know, to make it in this, in at least grasp it in the same way that that Siegel and Clint did, you know, all those years ago. But anyway, I was disappointed. But most people like it, though, Eric. You and I are in the minority.
Yeah, I don't think we're that far in the minority. I mean, they're the people who like it are really overpraising this thing, I think.
They love it. Yeah, people are really loving it. Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Yep.
All right, there's Eric and Colin, and we got more movies to talk about. That was The Beguiled. Colin liked it. Eric and I did not. And then we're going to take a quick break. We got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. They join me every Monday morning to review all the big movies. And so we are now going to review some more movies right here on 720 WGN. Let's welcome Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Welcome back, Colin.
Hello there.
All righty then. Colin, why don't you tell us about The Big Sick?
All right. Well, this is a romantic comedy starring Kumail Nanjiani, who you may know from the Pakistani actor, you may know from Community and Silicon Valley and Portlandia. And this is an autobiographical film in which he plays a younger version of himself as a struggling stand-up comic in Chicago who one night gets heckled, sort of, by a lovely white woman named Emily, played by Zoe Kazan. He talks to her after the show, and they banter and basically hit it off. They get to know each other over the course of a few weeks or a month. But she kind of keeps him at arm's length at first. But their relationship builds and gets more serious. But she eventually finds out that his parents keep trying to set him up into an arranged marriage, which he is not into at all. And she breaks up with him, knowing that for him it's either be with her or still have a family who won't ostracize him. And she can't live with that. And at this point, rather unexpectedly, she gets sick and put into a medically induced coma. And he's actually the one who takes her into the hospital and has to sign the papers for that to happen. And he waits for updates with her parents, who he just met, and they're played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. And they know the whole story of their breakup and would rather he not be around, but he insists on staying, and they start to form a bond as well while they wait for updates on her condition. I introduced it as a romantic comedy, and it might not sound like a romantic comedy as it goes along, and it certainly kind of keeps you on the edge of your seat in that respect for about the coma stuff. But all of the romantic comedy tone miraculously never changes throughout this film, even when it gets to that point, and it stays at that point for a long time. It's pretty much the entire second act. The key to that, of course, is the casting of Ray Romano and Holly Hunter. It's great to see Holly Hunter in a movie that is produced by Judd Apatow, and I can't underscore that enough because this is an Apatow production, so there are certain aspects of it that feel very much like one of his films, an improvisational feel to it. But it doesn't go overboard. It's not like the Amy Schumer movie from a couple of years ago. This is a very grounded piece of work. It's very personal and very heartfelt piece of work. But Ray Romano being brought into this is a really great touch. He's been trying to get into some more dramatic roles, like on the show Vinyl, which he's also pretty great in. But and this one, he's kind of has to straddle both being a dramatic actor and a comedic actor. And he does that balancing act perfectly in this. Holly Hunter is just beautiful, force of nature, as she always is, and is the perfect companion for him because you never quite know what she's going to do or say next. And it can't be said enough about Kumail Nanjiani's performance. I mean, you know, this is a very personal story for him as well. And of course, he wrote or co-wrote it. The film was directed by Michael Showalter, whose last film, My Name is Doris, was a nice piece of work, but I think he really stepped it up here and also had to find that balancing act of bringing in, you know, the terminal illness in with comedy, but, you know, kind of along the lines of 50-50 from a few years ago, but also Terms of Endearment deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as this film, I think. You know, movies that just kind of take on something very serious, but do it in a really profound and beautiful and funny way. And I think audiences are going to be really pleased walking out of this one. This is one of those films we can recommend unconditionally to anyone. It is very well worth seeing. It's one of the year's best films, and it's one of those effortlessly great films that you don't realize just how great it is while you're watching it. You know, everything about it clicks. There's not a false note in the whole thing for me.
Yeah. All right. Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I love it too. This is one of my favorite movies at Sundance this year, which is where it premiered. And you know, the way Colin, you know, talks about it and, you know, describes it in the kind of the rom-com terms, you know, this is a different kind of romantic comedy. You know, not just for being a true story, so that, you know, we have to sort of, you know, believe all of its twists and turns, but it's a rom-com that involves the man and the parents. You know, he's wooing the parents for the good portion of this movie, while the, you know, the potential love of his life is in a coma for a good section of the film. And I mean, Kumail Nanjiani, the script that he co-writes is really just beautifully just mandated all throughout the way it's structured, the way he brings in the complications with his own family, and with none of it feeling forced or cliched. You know, we've seen, you know, things like this before in movies, but you know, here, because it has that personal touch to it, it all feels all the more genuine. Colin already mentioned the performances in this movie. I mean, Kumail is terrific. Zoe Kazan really has never lit up a screen the way she has in this film. And Romano and Holly Hunter are just kind of perfect as her parents. Really funny, you know, harsh and hard when they need to be, particularly Hunter's character. The way that Romano is kind of lets his guard down and is just trying to, you know, help this guy along and help himself, you know, understand this relationship and the feelings that this guy has for his daughter. Again, not feeling in any sort of like kind of race baiting, you know, thing or anything like that, or it's like just challenging racism or anything like that. It all just feels really natural. There are a lot of jokes about, you know, his Pakistani nature. Some, at least one of maybe the best joke of the year in the film. And this, like you said, Colin, this is a film that you can recommend, you know, unconditionally to everyone. It has, you know, sort of a kind of a unique spoiler alert in who he co-wrote the film with. But by the end of this movie, it just ends on just one of those notes, just like, yeah, that's exactly where you want it to end. It's kind of perfect. So, yeah, one of the best films of the summer and one of the best films of the year.
Okay. We have to break here for the news, but when we come back, I'm going to basically say more than just exactly what you guys said. So, everybody, hang on. Eric and Colin both loved The Big Sick. Both think it's one of the best movies of the year. We're going to take a break, and I'll tell you what I think of it as well right after the news here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday. That means my dad will be calling in to tell a joke. Jokey, jokey, jokey time. Brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, Gale Street Inn. Check out GaleStreet.com. And we're reviewing the new movies. Before the break, Eric Childress and Colin Suter both gave their reviews of The Big Sick. And they both gave them glowing reviews. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, so here's my thought. It's one of the best movies of the year, and I pretty much loved every frame of it, and I thought it was just great in so many ways. You guys have covered a lot of it, but I would like to mention a few other things. First of all, it's really funny. I want to make sure people know how funny this movie is, because I laughed hard consistently throughout the entire movie. From beginning to end. It's a very funny movie, but that doesn't mean it doesn't take its subject matter very seriously, because it does. And it doesn't mean that the relationships don't feel real, because they do. It's just this really, really funny, three-dimensional, very, very real film. You know, the superlatives for Holly Hunter aren't enough. And Ray Romano, who, you know, I can take or leave the Everybody Loves Raymond show, you know, laugh at it a little bit here and there. His stand-up, I thought, was, you know, his stand-up was kind of funny. I do think that he, when he hosted SNL and they did that SportsCenter thing, that's still one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. And I mean, I know I'm going back a bunch of years for that, but great sassy Malassi. But he's become there's a turning point in his career. And I think it's when he did Men of a Certain Age, when he was, you know, he was the creator, co-creator of that show. He wrote some of the episodes. He and Andre Brower and Scott Bakula were so good on that show. And that was when I looked at him in a completely different light, when I was like, well, this guy really can't act. You mentioned Vinyl, Colin. He was terrific in Vinyl, one of the best things on that show. And I just like the direction that Ray Romano's career has taken as he's gotten a little bit older. And I think he's doing really great. He's phenomenal in this movie. There is a scene in the movie, and I won't go into details. You guys know what I'm talking about, where he's crashing in Kamal's room. And they have this this conversation that is both painfully honest and really funny and beautifully acted by both of those guys. Just amazing stuff. And Zoe Kazan, adorable and charming and funny and real. There's a scene where she wakes up in the middle of the night at his apartment and says she wants to go to the diner to get a cup of coffee. But then ultimately she reveals something else. And it's such a human moment and a funny moment and the kind of stuff that you don't see a lot of in real romantic comedies. Because in real life, that happens. What happens to her in the middle of the night happens to real people. And I love the way it was handled in the movie. It's a very human movie. It's beautifully written. And Showalter, best thing he's ever directed as far as I'm concerned. Handling of the subject matter, handling of the actors, making it consistently funny. I want to mention, you know, we're talking a lot about the Ray Romano, Holly Hunter stuff and her family. The stuff with his family is great. All of the scenes that take place at the dinner where the mother is trying to set him up with another girl who just happens to be in the neighborhood kills every time. The father, a great character. His brother, hilarious, the guy who plays his brother. The scene at the batting cages, I almost fell out of my chair laughing. And the relationship between that family, and it's very insightful in that way. A lot of people who go and see this movie might not know, you know, what the Pakistani family lifestyle is and what they believe in and how it's executed, even if you're not in Pakistan and you're here. It's all very insightful. You might even learn something about this culture, and it's respectful to the culture, and there are no stereotypes of any kind in any way. The stand-up subplot is fantastic in this movie. It's so good, Adie Bryant made me laugh. So, you know, and the guy who played Kurt Browner, who plays his roommate, is hysterical in this movie. And all the stand-up stuff obviously rings true because, you know, Kamal and all those guys are stand-ups, and Judd Apatow comes from the world of stand-up, and that feels real and honest and true. There's not a false moment in this movie. From the first frame to the ending, there's not one false moment. And it takes you on an emotional roller coaster ride. It really does. Because one minute I was laughing my ass off, and the next minute I was on the verge of tears. And you're talking about, you know, how you can recommend this to anybody. I went with my parents, who are in their 70s. They adored this movie. They don't know anything about stand-up comedy. You know, they weren't really sure. I mean, they knew a little bit about the Pakistani culture. And, you know, we walked out and we just had a great discussion afterwards about how funny and warm and human it was. It's a great movie. One of my favorite movies of the year. And I loved it, man. I just loved it. It was so good on every level. So anyway. So yeah, I think we all are recommending it. Am I right in that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's move on. Eric, why don't you tell everybody about Baby Driver?
Okay. Well, this is a new film from Edgar Wright. He's putting aside the members of the Cornetto trilogy, if you will, and said focusing on a getaway driver named Baby. It was played by Ansel Elgort. Due to a issue with tinnitus that he has, he is constantly playing his iPod, and he uses the music on his iPod to help guide him through the getaways for the bank heist that he is helping to pull off. These heists are arranged by a mysterious figure played by Kevin Spacey, who arranges sets up the heist and hires the crew with a revolving door of henchmen, some played by John Hamm and Aiza Gonzalez and John Berthal, and then notably Jamie Foxx, who is quite a wrinkle into this whole dynamic. Another wrinkle that enters is a waitress played by Lily James, who Baby takes quite a fancy to, and it's very easy to see why. Most of his life has been dedicated to serving Kevin Spacey's character due to an incident in his youth. He is on the verge of getting out of this world and sees her, hopefully, to be a part of this. But, you know, complications arise and not everyone's done with the past. The past isn't certainly done with them, as one of Nick's movies likes to say. He has to continue pulling off these heists and then try to pull his life together. That's just a plot description of this movie. This is a action comedy, mostly stressed on the action that I first saw at the South by Southwest Film Festival in March, where the film premiered, which I loved it then, and I saw it again this weekend, and I love it even more, frankly. This is a movie that, when you hear the central gimmick of the film, that a lot of the chase scenes and the action scenes, whether it involves cars or guns or foot chases, are all set to music. The iPod is its own character within the film. So there is a beat, there's a rhythm. The easiest way to describe the film is to go back to Shaun of the Dead and just watch the Don't Stop Me Now sequence in the Winchester. That's pretty much the impetus for this film. And if you go in there just expecting that gimmick, you might be looking for it here and there. And I think that was part of my mistake the first time while I was watching it, even though it's pulled off beautifully and it's wonderful to see every time. There's a lot more going on in this film that I picked up on the second time. A lot more to love about the way Edgar Wright not just crafts the really terrific action scenes people are focusing on the car chases. It has one of the best foot chases that I've seen in some time. Some of the gunplay is really creative and really wonderfully put together. The way that Edgar Wright uses sound in this movie, it's not just the music, but background noise and the way the tinnitus is actually brought into the story. And the first time that I saw the film, like the one kind of nagging complaint that I had was Ansel Elgort's performance in the movie, that I think that, this is not an actor that we've seen a lot of, but I thought that in Baby Driver, he's very much in his wheelhouse in the scenes where he's either A, being quiet, or B, sort of wooing the Lily James character, who is just a doll in this movie. But when he tries to sort of act tougher, it didn't quite register with me. This time, watching his performance a little more closely and seeing how his character is kind of changing in the past and the way that the situation is kind of weighing down on him in the film, it completely reestablished, what I was seeing the first time with his performance. And I think it's pretty special now. I assume everyone really liked this movie, so there's going to be a lot more to talk about. I will mention really quick that, Edgar Wright being a student of film, which, again, I'm sure is going to be brought up, there's a friend of mine who I saw with last night was so quick to point out Baby's wardrobe in the film, which, if you recall, a certain Scoundrel for Hire and a certain science fiction space opera trilogy, that his wardrobe is very similar to that character. And I said, that's not an accident. And there's very, very little of that, you know, could be deemed as an accident in this film because it's really pretty special.
All right, hang on, guys. We got to take a break, and then Colin will find out what you thought of Baby Driver, and then I'll tell you what I thought of Baby Driver. And that's all coming up right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 o'clock. It's a Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and they continue. And it is Monday, which means my dad will tell a joke, and we will talk box office as well. Eric Childress, welcome back, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin Suter, welcome back.
Hey,
before the break, Eric told us all about Baby Driver and gave it a rave review. And so now, Colin, what did you think of Baby Driver?
Yeah, it's really terrific. And I think it also brought to mind another quote that I remember of Henry Gibson on a documentary about the Blues Brothers, who's saying, you know, the last chase scene in that movie is a musical number. It doesn't sound much like look like a musical number, but those cars are dancing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I feel about this movie, too. It is a musical. It's its own kind of unique, visceral musical that is really intoxicating and fun to watch. You get a really giddy feeling from, especially the opening sequence, when it's kind of introducing the whole concept. There's a point at which John Hamm gives Baby Driver, you know, very encouraging tap on the shoulder during this insane car chase. And that's kind of how you feel. If Edgar Wright was sitting next to you, you'd be doing the same thing to him watching this movie, saying, yeah, man, you're really doing this beautifully. I love that it doesn't just parlay itself into the car chases, but every other aspect of his life. He's just walking down the street. It's a musical. When he's taking care of his, what's his relative?
Foster. It's his foster father.
Right, his foster father.
Right.
There's a musical sensibility to that. I love their relationship. You know, just a nice little touch that this father is hard of hearing. So they have this nice little connection with that. The use of music, obviously, the songs that are chosen aren't obvious songs. Edgar Wright digs pretty deep for the soundtrack on this film. As a Beck fan, I love the use of Deborah, that song. It's a very, very tongue-in-cheek, very funny song, actually. It was nice to see it used in this way. You know, I just was delighted from beginning to end with this movie. And I'm very anxious to see it again to see if I do like it more. Because I do like the Cornetto trilogy as a whole more than this. But I definitely want to see this again. Definitely want to take people to see it. I'm very encouraged by its numbers this weekend. I definitely think that this is another movie, like The Big Sick, but on a totally different level, that you can pretty much recommend to anybody. Just looking for just a fun night out at the movies. I mean, this is what that's what this movie is. So yeah, definitely highly recommend it.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say. I absolutely adored every single frame of this movie, and it's my favorite film so far this year. And a lot of good movies have come out this year, but I think this is the best one I've seen. It is wholly original. It is so beautifully shot. You mentioned giddiness, Colin. There were sequences in this movie while I was watching it where I just started to tear up with joy. You know what I mean? Like, I was just mm-hmm. like, this is just amazing. This is beautiful. And I'm kind of overwhelmed by what I'm watching and hearing right now. The opening 15 minutes, you know, the big chase at the beginning that is so beautifully done that leads into the opening credits, which is a one-take musical number. Just so good. And this guy loves cinema so much. Edgar Wright so loves movies. You can tell he loves to make movies, and he makes great movies. I thought the lead was great, Ansel Elgort. I'm not really, really familiar with his work, but I thought he was great. I thought the relationship between him and Lily James was really sweet and had sort of a fable aspect to it. And as the whole movie had that kind of a feel, it felt like it was based in some sort of reality, but it was heightened. Not just the car chase scenes and the foot chases and the shootouts and stuff, but everything in the movie was just kind of heightened to a different reality, this world that lives inside Edgar Wright's head. And it's a wonderful, creative, insanely brilliant world. And the song choices are amazing. The foot chase towards the end of the film to Hocus Pocus by Focus is one of my favorite film sequences, like, ever. I was losing my mind during that scene. I adore that song, and it's fantastic. And the fact that he used it was great. And all of the stuff, the relationship stuff is great. But the heist stuff, it's not like we've never seen a heist movie before, but we've never seen a heist movie like this. And I really thought the characters were great. I love John Hamm in it. I love John Bernthal in it. I thought Yves Gonzalez was great in it. Kevin Spacey was great. But I got to say, I loved Jamie Foxx in this movie. And that's a sentence that doesn't come out of my mouth very often. He's great in it. Jamie Foxx is great. And I think it's the best thing he's ever done. And I'm including Ray. I think he's phenomenal in this movie and provides provides a much needed edge through most of the film. That then is sort of taken over by John Hamm in the final part of the movie. So it's great, man. And the relationship between Kevin Spacey and Baby is really interesting. And that leads to a great thing that happens in the third act of the movie. The relationship between his foster father is really great. And the romantic relationship is great. So on every level, this is a triumph, an absolute triumph. And it's a remarkable piece of cinema that is just joyous and creative. And I loved every single frame of this movie. And I'm going again to see it on Saturday with my folks. My birthday is this week, so we're going to go out and have some dinner at Gale Street on Saturday right after we see Baby Driver. And I'm telling you right now, my dad's going to go nuts for this movie. My dad is going to lose his mind. So I loved it. It's my favorite film of the year so far. So this week, two of my favorite films of the year were released, this and The Big Sick. And that's a pretty damn good week, I think. And I know, Colin, you like The Beguiled, and a lot of people like The Beguiled. So a lot of people are talking about the three movies that start with B. That came out this weekend that everybody loved. So a good weekend. Now, none of us saw The House, so we don't know how bad that was. But, yeah. But you guys will be back in Thursday morning, and we'll go down our list of our 10 favorite movies and the 10 worst movies. But so we'll be talking about a couple of the movies we talked about tonight on Thursday, I know for sure. So anyway, that's happening. And then next week, basically, Spider-Man is the big release, correct?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, here's the deal. Hey, Colin, thanks, man.
Sure, man.
And have a good week, and we'll talk to you Thursday morning.
Sounds good.
All right. There's Colin. He's going to go. Eric, you hang on, okay?
Sounds good.
Eric Childress joins me after the break, and as we do every week, we will take apart the box office figures. Eric does a piece for movies.com. We talk about that, and we'll talk about the box office right after this on 720 WGN. Hi, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio on the seventh floor, Trip Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. And then it's no opening bell this morning. It's just going to be Pete and Jane starting at 5, hosting from 5 through morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're off tomorrow for the 4th of July, and John Hansen and Esmeralda Leon will be filling in for us tomorrow. So thanks to them, but we're going to take the 4th off for the holiday. All right, but we will be back on Wednesday morning. So right now, we're going to talk box office. Eric Childress writes a piece for movies.com, and then we talk about the box office every Monday morning. And Eric, tell everybody how they can see you on the TVs.
Yeah, every Thursday morning, although not this Thursday morning. I will not be on this week, but normally every Thursday morning on a show called Business First AM on WYCC Television, I do a segment called Movies and Money, and we basically talk about the new releases and their box office potential and any box office stories that creep into it.
All right, cool. Well, let's talk about the box office. Despicable Me 3, $75.4 million. Is that the lowest of the series?
No, the first one opened to lower than that. I mean, that was just, the thing was getting started and didn't really, develop into the phenomenon that it did eventually. Is lower than the second movie, which opened to $83 million. So there's a couple raised eyebrows about that. Some people thought that it was projected as about $81 million this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of trailed off a little bit more than expected, but a $75 million opening, that's still the sixth best opening of the year.
Right.
So it's hardly a bad opening. And, it is going to be curious to see how the thing trails off, particularly because there really is no family competition just almost at all for the next 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's this, and then you have three more weekends to itself, basically, until the Emoji Movie opens. And I don't know if anyone really cares about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even less people care about the Nut Job 2.
Right.
So Despicable Me 3 at the very least has the family audience cornered for the rest of the summer.
Now, do these movies do well overseas?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Despicable Me 2 almost made $1 billion worldwide, and Minions exceeded $1 billion. So
The Minions movie made over $1 billion?
Yes, yes, sir.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Despicable Me 2 did $368 million just in the U.S. Minions did a little bit less, but it did much more overseas. Minions did something like $1.15 billion, I believe.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so
wow.
the Despicable Me franchise is like Despicable Me, you know, is like Despicable Me, Fast and the Furious, and, you know, a few Spielberg movies. That's Universal's legacy right there. Those are like the most successful movies of all time.
Wow.
Universal.
Amazing. All right. Baby Driver, $21 million over the weekend, but it opened on Wednesday, and total of $30 million, which is really good, correct?
Yeah. This is a movie that I am ecstatic to be wrong about, because when Sony moved this thing from August into this particular slot this week, I thought that they did it a huge disservice. I thought opening it in the wake of Transformers and right before Spider-Man was going to kill any potential momentum this movie might have. I thought, you know, it was going to open to maybe, you know, like 11, 12 million, and then, you know, if lucky, build some word of mouth and just kind of stick around for a few more weeks. But word of mouth, you know, preceded it.
Yeah.
So, you know, people were on board with this thing, and opening on a Wednesday was a really smart move. So, I mean, $30 million. This movie, in 5 days, has already made more than any of the Cornetto films.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's almost, and by tomorrow, or today, as a matter of fact, it'll be gross more than Scott Pilgrim. So this is going to be Edgar Wright's most successful film to date.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It deserves it. It deserves it, too. It's so great. It's just so great.
$34 million budget. I mean, this film, at the very least, should be pulling in like what Don't Breathe did last summer.
Mm-hmm.
It has that kind of momentum to it. And we're going to see if the word of mouth sticks around, you could see this be kind of like the surprise $100 million film of the year.
Yeah, that'd be great, too. That's so good. Number three, Transformers The Last Knight, $17 million, $102 million. This is just not good, in America at least.
Not in America, no. I mean, it's $429 million worldwide right now. So it's, you know, it's kind of where it needs to be worldwide. It needs to be a lot more if Paramount wants to make any cash on this thing.
Right.
But the U.S. numbers, this film might not make $150 million.
Wow.
And if it makes like 140, that's like $100 million less than the last film.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, I mean, if this movie pulls in 750, 800 million worldwide, Paramount will, you know, won't even care about the U.S. They'll just make these movies for the overseas crowd.
Right.
Because there's already a sixth and a seventh film on the schedule.
What?
For them, yeah. Yeah, not to mention they just put Top Gun 2 on the schedule, too.
Oh. All right. Yeah. Who's directing Top Gun 2?
Well, you maybe not so much for you, but for me, it's Joseph Kaczynski.
Oh, okay.
Oblivion.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Tron Legacy.
Yeah, all right. Let's see. Wonder Woman, the juggernaut continues. $16 million, and it's up to $347 million just in the U.S. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, no. These are the numbers I wish Baby Driver would be hitting right now. but no, this is the movie that will not go away, and it is just $10 million off the pace of where Guardians was at the same period. So it's going to pass $400 million. It's going to happen.
Yeah, that's amazing. It really is. I mean, that's just like the success of the summer.
No, without question.
All right, number five is Cars 3, $9.5 million, $120 million total. That's not good.
No, another film that's probably not going to crack $150 million in the U.S., it'll be the second lowest Pixar gross of all time. Not to mention, there's a great Pixar joke in Baby Driver, too.
Yes, there is.
Oh, God, that's so great. Particularly considering that Kevin Spacey's in A Bug's Life, which Cars 3 is not going to outgross.
Oh, man.
And Pixar has a kind of a history of unleashing their films overseas a little bit later than the U.S. release.
Mm-hmm.
So the word really isn't out on whether or not if this is going to be a success or not.
Wow. Here's a big one, too. Man, The House coming in at number six with only $9 million. This is an Amy Poehler, Will Ferrell comedy in the summer. And wow, did it tank.
This is stunning. And I really would like to do, you know, like you know, if I had time to sort of hunker down and like look at the kind of the trends that are going on right now. I mean, for one thing, comedies are not doing well right now. You know, at least the big name comedies aren't doing particularly well. And I'm just wondering if audiences are getting more savvy, if they're just, I mean, like, you know, Despicable Me numbers are down, Transformers, Pirates, you know, all these movies just like, all right, enough already. And, you know, if the people knew kind of early on that this was not being screened for press, I mean, we started shouting that, you know, as soon as we knew about it.
Yeah.
And then it opens with a 15% at Rotten Tomatoes. People are starting to pay attention to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw Baywatch, The Mummy, these films that, you know, 20% or lower this summer, Transformers as well. People are paying attention.
Yeah, and a lot of the comedies that have been coming out, just, you know, like Rough Night and Chips, and you mentioned
and
Baywatch.
Yeah.
They're just really totally underperforming or just tanking.
Yeah, and you were thinking that people would need to laugh right now.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how Girls' Night does. Or Girls Trip.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see that because it's a different audience. It's aimed at African American women,
right?
And that's different than the Rough Night movie, which was clearly aimed at white chicks,
right? And those films do have a history of having a kind of a front loaded opening weekend.
Yeah,
their fans show up for those movies, so.
Right.
It wouldn't surprise me if, like, Girls Trip, like, outgrosses Rough Night on the opening weekend.
Oh, I would agree with that completely. I mean, because a lot of people love Queen Latifah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a massive audience for those kinds of films, it's proven that African Americans will go to see a movie opening weekend. There's no question about it, especially if it's a film that is, you know, marketed to them. And I love Tiffany Haddish, so that's the only thing that I'm really looking forward to with that one. But The House bombed. Number seven, 47 Meters Down, $4.6 million. The best grossing straight-to-video movie ever?
I think so. As I said in my column, I would love to see, like, the IRS, like, do the books on this one. Because if Byron Allen tries to post a loss on this one, just immediate audit.
Right. Number eight, The Beguiled, good enough to get into the top ten, $3.2 million.
Yeah, went kind of semi-wide. It's just under 700 theaters, like 650 theaters, somewhere around there. That's a good number. I have a feeling that what you're going to see next week is that that's going to drop, and Big Sick is going to replace it as it gets into more theaters. That's going to go wide on July 14th. But I think the way The Beguiled has been advertised. One thing we know about audiences too is that they don't like to be duped into seeing something that they think they're seeing, and then it turns out to be something different.
Yeah.
The Beguiled is all like last 20 minutes in the previews.
Right.
So if they're going in to think that, I think that, you know, even the art house crowd, you know, might, you know, scoff at.
But the big Sick did well this weekend.
It did very well. I mean, the opening weekend, it was the of all time, it was the 40th best opening per screen average of all time.
Wow.
It sounds like a high number, but that's a good list to be on.
Yeah.
And this week, I examined like all the films that were still like under 100 theaters in their second week. And I mean, this is a good list too. I mean, Grand Budapest Hotel, Black Swan, Brokeback Mountain, Up in the Air, Midnight in Paris, Blue Jasmine, and then The Big Sick. And as far as how much money they made in their second weekend, still being in less than 100 theaters.
Wow, that's a
It's a good solid list, and it shows that the word of mouth is going to spread on this film. And I think by the time it's July 14th, you're going to see this film really kind of be a little surprise, a little breakthrough.
And deserves it.
Absolutely.
It's such a great movie. Such a great movie. Okay, some really strong couple of movies came out this week. We will talk about Spider-Man next week in the box office then. But you guys will be here Thursday morning, and we will do our half-year lists, 10 best, 10 worst.
Yep.
All right, cool. Thanks, Eric.
Sure thing.
Take care, buddy. All right. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join us every Monday, but they will also be with us this coming Thursday morning to do our six-month half-year lists. All right?